Open loops. Open loops. Open loops. Open loops. Open loops. You must listen to the open loops, a theme park for absurd beliefs and systems of integration between the mind and the creative spirit. Open loops.
How in the world can one premium cable network have Tony Soprano, CGI Dragons, and Larry David? Your conscious mind can focus on that, while your unconscious mind is now tuned in to its favorite late-night talk show for the shamelessly fringe. It's Open Loops with Greg Bornstein. Conversations that bend. Yes, Looper. Looper. Welcome. Greg Bornstein here, host, cultural hypnotist, consciousness disruptor, chief looper, and curator of your auditory experience here on Open Loops. Welcome. You are in for a discussion that I didn't think would go the way it did. Jonathan Venkin is coming up. Now, what is this show for those who have never tuned in before? Of course, it is a tribute. It is a love letter to thoughts, feelings, ideas, taboos, controversial takes, really anything mind-bending that is designed to challenge your existing belief systems with radically unique ideas designed to stimulate your unconscious mind and allow you to step into the highest version of yourself. As you know, or may not know yet, we're delving into all the different kind of topics, right? The conspiratorial, the spiritual, the magical, the hypnotic, the paranormal, the supernatural, the esoteric, the metaphysical, the philosophical, the psychoanalytical. Really, anything that makes your brain go, whoa. Those exact three. They're emojis. Can you imagine the emoji that goes with them? You know, interestingly enough, I've had quite a hypnotic week since even the last James Tripp episode we put out. I, well, a couple things. First of all, Monday night, I went to see Hip-Prov, which is an improv comedy / hypnosis show with Colin Mochrie of Whose Line Is It Anyway. Such a fun time. Now, I have to tell you, from a hypnosis perspective, a little weak. I mean, it was a classic progressive relaxation induction, which, for those of you, very early on, I talked about the distinctions of ways of inducing hypnosis. This was super, super standard. Almost unimpressive how standard it was. And it was weird that the hypnotist, every time he would, I mean, I know I play with that on this show a little bit, but every time the hypnotist would start going into trance mode, his hypnotic voice, it was almost as if he was playing at it And just go deeper, deeper. Yeah, that's right. Just dipping down now. Go inside yourself and looking through your real eyes as you real eyes the... you know, whatever. Decent hypnotic language ambiguities, all this stuff. But, you know, I don't know. Here's my thought. This guy brought 20 people up on stage. He winnowed it down to five. Five people to be in this hypnotized improv group that comedian Colin Mochrie would do scenes with. Really fun premise, really good. I'm not sure. Maybe there's a possibility that one out of those five people was actually hypnotized. And he was doing a progressive relaxation. And they all looked like they were in their early 20s. Which, if you go to enough stage hypnosis shows, and you know there are a lot of hypnotists that do it in college campuses, college campuses are a great, great gig for working stage hypnotists. People are already suggestible, they're drunk, they're still developmentally taking things in and open to being exhibitionist and all this stuff. Not that I shouldn't say you're not supposed to be drunk and hypnotized, but what I mean is that they're drunk with a lust for exploring life, and in a hypnosis show allows that exhibition. I just think they were actual. I mean, this show took place in Union Square in New York City. I think they were just actors, not actors that were vetted before, but actual people who were working in showbiz and or NYU students that Colin struck gold on. And as I'll say, Colin did a great job, but the hypnosis, I give a C minus. The comedy from Colin Mochrie, given that things were tricky because I couldn't tell who was hypnotized and who wasn't, I give it a B plus. I really had a good time. It was a very fun show. I love seeing Colin. I've seen him live before. But, you know, it's tricky when the hypnosis, when you just don't think people are hypnotized, and actually somebody sitting in back said he had participated in the show, sitting behind me, was talking to his friend, and I overheard him, and the friend turns to him and goes, "Wait, so were you hypnotized?" And the guy goes, "No, of course not." So, eh. But I will say, definitely check it out, because you never know, that could have just been my night. It's a different show every night. Colin Mochrie is brilliant. Whose Line was one of my top influences growing up. Used to watch it Thursday nights on ABC, 8 to 9. One of my favorite, one of the foundational childhood shows for me. Now, the other hypnosis experience. Some of you may remember Ann Jersch from AlterCon. It was a series we did where we talked about altered state of consciousness with a hypnosis bent. Ann Jersch came on, and she's a futurist. She's a future life projectionist, which is the opposite of past life regression. She teaches it. She specializes in bringing people to future states and future visioning and businesses, and she even does psychic readings, and that was her original foray into all of this, tarot readings, but she became a hypnotist, and I really love Anne. She's got a great sense of humor. Something about her is just really compelling to me. If you haven't listened to the episode with Ann Jersch, that's J-I-R-S-C-H, go back, check that out. It was one of my favorites. And one of the reasons that I met with her was because of something she said on that episode, which was, "Greg, I need to do a session with you and bring you to the future." I love it. I love it. Yes, episode 165. Feel free to listen to that. It's a really good one. Her story's so interesting. She took me to a future life. 5 years in the future. I told her my birthday, gave her some preliminary background information, and she decided, I'm going to bring you 5 years to the future. And let me just tell you, it was super helpful. Such an interesting vision. I mean, really, you know, obviously I'm reckoning with it in a way and building this out. It definitely involves cool colored smoke, and there's a castle in there. I mean, we'll see 5 years from now. But the point is that to anchor you to your future self is something I highly recommend you check out. Look up Anne Jersch and her work as a future life progressionist. Highly recommend either learning from her, even getting a session from her or one of the practitioners. You can go back to episode 165 to find out all the details on Anne. How about today's episode? Jonathan Vanken, someone that I learned from Robert McGuffey, who came on to talk about Operation Mind F, the book about QAnon. Jonathan Vanken was doing that stuff in the 90s, was analyzing conspiracy theories and bringing them to light in a more fun, playful way. And in a way that I originally started this show with the intention of doing. And then, of course, you know, I do love a lot of the really out there conspiracies still that may have even a hint of, oh, I could see why they formulated this, but we get into it on the show. Even Jonathan has distanced himself from the traditional conspiracy of I would say today's popular conspiracies, the stuff you see on BitChute, the stuff you see on Truth Social, really, the stuff you see from that is used to politically divide people today. I mean, conspiracies were not supposed to be that mainstream. Kind of like improv. They were supposed to be this fringe fun thing, and then everybody started doing them. And how often do you actually want to go out and, besides, you know, when you get a comp ticket to a hypnosis show that involves the greatest improviser of all time, how often do you actually want to see improv? Well, most people don't, and frankly, most people aren't as excited by conspiracies these days, except you, dear listener. That's why you're here with me. We're still looking for the edges of this topic. We're still exploring why they're popular, which ones might be based in reality, which ones could perhaps allow us to see the world in a completely different way. There's no question this interview, for some of you, will put an interesting critical lens on conspiracies from somebody that arguably could be connected to the perpetuation of them. But his latest book, Close to Zero, about Donald Trump and COVID and out front, in front of our very eyes, leading us to an apocalyptic vision where basically he is serving as Putin's puppet and trying to kill off at least half of the American population. Is it quite a conspiracy? It still has the threads of it. It's just a little more in plain sight. We're going to talk about that a lot. What Jonathan thinks of Trump, his book Close to Zero. It's in the show notes. You're going to have to check that out. I'm loving it so far. Jonathan is a great, great writer. And, I thought his views on conspiracy were very, well, a lot less forgiving than even some of the conversations I've had. I take a very agnostic approach to all this stuff. I want to examine all angles. I think Jonathan does too. I think he's just, you'll listen and find out. If you like this podcast, please make sure to subscribe. And if you can rate the show and leave a review, even a couple of words, go to ratethispodcast.com/openloops and let us know you're enjoying it. It really helps this content get out there when you rate the show and leave a review. So I'm so grateful for that. All right, enough with the hypnosis. Let's dehypnotize the masses on what happened in 2020. Here he is, Jonathan Vankin. Today on Open Loops, we have Jonathan Vankin, author of many, many interesting works. He's a writer of books, comics, screenplays, journalism, and even a musical, with a new book, Close to Zero, the full story of how, and more importantly, why Donald Trump allowed the COVID-19 pandemic to devastate the United States and kill 500,000 Americans. It's available at Amazon. It's very interesting. We're going to talk about that, but also lots of works about conspiracy over the years. And
yes.
I am definitely excited. I mean, if you got Robert Anton Wilson calling your book the sanest and at the same time most exciting conspiracy book I've read this decade. That was in 1991.
That was a few decades ago.
Yes. I'm honored to have you. Thank you so much for coming on, Jonathan.
Oh, thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, I'm so grateful you were still out there. You know, I don't know if you know this guy. Do you know Robert McGuffey at all?
No, the name does not ring a bell, I have to admit.
That's funny, because he referenced your work in an interview I just did. He wrote a book about QAnon called Operation Mindfuck, and it was you probably could have written that book too, because he he looked at QAnon, and as somebody that loved alternative in the early 90s, he was saying, looking at conspiracy literature and these underground magazines and all this kind of stuff where conspiracy was talked about left and right, he became an aficionado and knew about all the things that QAnon was doing to meld different conspiracies. And he had a bunch of Salon articles where he was breaking it down and saying, this is the greatest love letter to conspiracies ever, and it's dangerous, and here's why. And obviously it led to what happened January 6th, but he mentioned your name in that episode. And he said, oh yeah, you know, Jonathan Vankin's work. There was this big book about, it expanded to 80 of the greatest conspiracies ever. And I thought, oh my gosh, if this guy who was writing about this stuff before conspiracies were cool is still out there, I need to have him on the show.
I'm still out here. I'm still here. Still kicking.
I love it, Jonathan. I mean, it's very funny. Did it feel different back then? In a way, let me ask you this. It seemed, I know that my uncle, who is a big pop culture fan, exposed, I mean, he's my dad's sister's husband, so not blood related, but he introduced me to Mad magazine. He was like a big George Carlin, big comedic influence, also kind of delved into conspiracy stuff. But I was talking to him during the pandemic and I said, yeah, what do you think about all these conspiracies? And he goes, Greg, I'm not into that as much anymore, because they became political. And I thought about that and went, yeah, I think you're right. Once Trump and the alt-right became so conspiracy heavy, all those like GeoCities websites from the late 90s and 2000s, and certainly building off of your work, It seemed a little less, in a way, when it become when it's mainstream, it's a little less fun. Do you think, I mean, how do you feel about your work in the context of when it came out versus where conspiracy as a whole is now?
Well, it's a good question. Obviously, I've thought about that quite a bit. And, to me, when I first started doing that, researching that topic, it was really like the late 1980s. And my first book, which was called Conspiracies, Cover-ups, and Crimes, came out in 1991, as you know from seeing that quote by Robert Anton Wilson. And, then the conspiracies, the greatest conspiracy series that I did with my collaborator, John Whalen. I think the first one came out in 95. So, this was a while ago. And at that time, it really felt to me, let's put it this way, the media environment seemed very different. And the sort of popular environment or mindset also seemed very different. And it felt to me that in those days, these conspiracy theories were, in their own sort of bizarre and interesting way, a way of challenging authority. I wouldn't necessarily say speaking truth to power because there's not necessarily truth in them. Some there is, of course, but not in everything, every conspiracy theory by far. But it was a way of sort of questioning authority, challenging sort of the consensus reality, the consensus, like I guess the expression you hear a lot is the Overton window, that spectrum of acceptable debate. And the conspiracy theories really were challenging that. And they felt to me in those days a really good way of questioning that, of questioning authority, and maybe taking authority in that way, and taking the things that we're quote unquote supposed to believe, down a peg. But I think that has done a complete 180, and I think that in recent years, and certainly with the Trump era, just went into overdrive, but even before that, this trend was starting that these conspiracy theories became a tool of power and a tool of authority and a way to manipulate people, manipulate the public, shape their views. And they're essentially now used purely as propaganda. And, it's not the same thing. The people I interviewed for my first book, some of them were pretty off the wall. Some of them had political views that I would find, very repellent, but all of them I felt had one thing in common, which is that they really did. You hear this expression all the time, do your research, and it's usually derided because people who say that don't really mean it, and they're just talking about like looking on YouTube or on the internet, and that's quote unquote research. The people I talked to back then, 30 years ago, really did do their research. I mean, they really researched things heavily. And the famous Mae Brussel, who unfortunately passed away shortly before I was able to, was before I started the book, and by the time I reached out to contact her, she had recently passed on. But which was very sad at the time. This was the late 80s. But she, I mean, as a she just researched things incessantly. I mean, she kept these massive file cabinets full of newspaper clippings, and this is of course the days before the internet, where you actually had to subscribe to dozens of newspapers if you were in her position, and clip articles and save them. And she first got into all this back in the 1960s when she looked at the Warren Commission report, obviously about the JFK assassination. And the Warren Commission report, the Warren Commission at the time issued all of its evidence, 26 volumes of evidence, testimony as well as physical evidence, they published it. And she purchased these volumes, and she meticulously, single-handedly cross-referenced and indexed all of them. That was real research, and that was very valuable. That's not what's happening anymore. The people, these so-called conspiracy theorists now don't do any of that. They just regurgitate things that they've heard. And that's what is very upsetting to me. I mean, I don't even really like to use the word theory anymore, because when you say, oh, it's a theory, a conspiracy theory, that implies there's some sort of intellectual process that you've gone through to arrive at this conclusion, and that you can maybe test this hypothesis in some way, this theory. These aren't theories that you're hearing QAnon and all this crazy stuff, and the election was stolen. These aren't theories, they're just beliefs. And I'm not even sure a lot of the people who espouse them actually believe them or care whether they're true or not. They're just there as propaganda to reinforce a certain power structure, which in this case is this sort of ultra right wing, you know, what you would now call Trumpist or Trumpian, you know, power structure, I suppose. So to me, you know, it's they've really lost interest in that way for me, because I mean, I'm interested in them as a political phenomenon and as a way that propaganda is used. But in terms of like looking at conspiracy theories as something that might actually be able to enlighten you in some strange way, I think that ship sailed.
Wow. Makes me sad for sure.
It is sad. It really is. You know, it shouldn't be that way. And, you know, even back in the days when I was doing this, writing these conspiracy books about conspiracy theories, it felt to me even then that like this shouldn't even be necessary. Like we should have much more open discussion of various points of view and things, you know, about real things like the Kennedy assassination or the other assassinations by 1960s or things that happened in Vietnam and Watergate. I mean, all these things really happened and were real conspiracies. And I think there's still a lot that we don't know about all those events, including Watergate. You know, there was just that series that was on called Gaslit. And I don't know if you watched any of that. There was all a dramatization of the Watergate story. And there was also a great new book called Watergate, A New History by a writer named Garrett Graff. You know, I've read tons of books on Watergate, and I read his book and I still learn new things. And you really come to the realization that here's this thing that happened 50 years ago, and we still don't really know why it happened, which is amazing to me. And that to me is a really legitimate subject of research, you know, things we should really be looking into. That's not really what these people are doing anymore.
Well, here's what I am curious about this. Do you think that there are some things now that, for instance, just seem off and worth still investigating, i.e., you know, Epstein and the Maxwell trial? I mean, I even know that, look, I'm not going to say that there was a conspiracy, but there are questions from the alt-right about the recent shooting in Texas, because they ruled that we're not going to show the body cam footage. And that makes people go, well, wait, why wouldn't we? I mean, and there might be a legitimate reason there, but I mean, not even that shooting. The Vegas shooting has unanswered questions still. I know those are more poppy. I know those have more of a political bent to them. But there definitely is a public out there that's going, hey, if this isn't a conspiracy or something, why aren't you giving us this information?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, one of the things when I first started, again, when I first was writing about this years and years ago, I think one of the reasons that conspiracy theories were so popular was that there's always been a reflex on the part of not just government, but any type of authority structure, power structure, corporations, whatever, to withhold information and to not be, you know, the current word in vogue is transparent. Back then, I didn't hear that word very much, but that's come into vogue recently, like transparency. Yes. You just don't, you know, it's resisted, and on the part of people who shouldn't be resisting it, you know, we definitely need more of a greater flow of information about everything. So, you know, I mean, I don't even really want to get into those things about the shootings, because so much of that, again, is like this, just this baloney about, you know, there's just people who don't want gun control.
Right.
So basically, when you have these horrendous atrocities committed that would not have been committed without the easy availability of guns, they're just looking for any reason to change the subject or claim that they never happened or some horrible stuff like that. So, yeah, any type of crime like that needs to be properly investigated. And the police and other investigators need to be open about what they're finding and what the hell is going on. But at the same time, it's like, I don't think in these cases, it just doesn't look to me like even that sometimes reticence on the part of official, you know, the official authorities who investigate these things is what is motivating the conspiracy theories. The conspiracy theories are being motivated by something completely different.
It's kind of true.
And they would exist no matter what. And you know, even when you have openness of information, you still get these theories, because if the facts don't agree with your point of view, you have to reject them. And that's, you know, that to me is really not healthy and really terrible for society, and it's kind of what's happening. So, you know, it's discouraging, frankly. I mean, I don't really have a very optimistic point of view about that sort of thing right now, about the future of our culture as one that's bending towards rationality and enlightenment. I think we're kind of moving in the other direction.
I mean, was that your back then? Were you, because look, even the 80 greatest conspiracies book, I mean, you're getting praise from mainstream publication, right? Newsweek gave a great review of this. So when you see that, all of a sudden you're going, huh, okay, well, is this a, you know, is this guy like a real conspiracy writer, or is he kind of poking fun at this stuff? But at the same time, I believe from what I've read so far, and the way you look at things, there are some inch there are points in there that make you question. So I guess my thought is this, or my question is this, how much did you believe in some of the things you were exploring back then, and were you was your mind changed after talking to people about things you were initially more skeptical about?
Well, you know, back then, yeah, I mean, my mind was, I would say, I don't know as I changed, but definitely opened. You know, for the first book, the before I did the greatest conspiracies thing, the first book where I actually spent 2 years just going around and interviewing these people in person and on the phone, and just a wide range of people I interviewed from the left to the right to just the off the charts. You know, I talked to all of them, and it was, and I did it in this spirit of openness, really. I mean, and it was really, that was my thought experiment going into it. You know, I wanted to do, I think I called it at the time, like a mental new journalism or a mental participatory journalism. Whereas instead of being like someone like Hunter Thompson who goes and like hangs out with a motorcycle gang for a year, you know, I didn't do that. But sort of in my mind, I was like, all right, I'm gonna deliberately put my mind in the headspace of these conspiracy theorists, and I'm going to be just totally open to everything they have to say. And I made that conscious decision, and you know that was a lot easier to do when I was younger. I mean, today it's like I feel so much more jaded, frankly, and so many more things have happened that have been, you know, that have been you know, negative. And I mean, the personal experiences. I mean, just in the country, you know, we've had negative experiences in the country and throughout the world, and we have this trend towards fascism and authoritarianism, not just in this country, but in many other countries in Europe and Asia, and it's bad, you know. I mean, because ultimately, what was all about for me from the very beginning, it's about freedom of thought, and it's about being able to think what you want to think and what you need to think, and that's how we get at the truth, and that's how we improve, is by being open to points of view that aren't necessarily our own. Or new points of view, there's things that we just haven't thought of. And that was, I felt back then, you know, being stifled in a, you know, in a great to a greater extent than maybe even now. But now, as I said before, I think a lot of these so-called conspiracy theories are used to stifle that free inquiry and free thought. So really, it's all about freedom for me. And I feel like the trend in this country and the world is going in the other direction. You know, it's going in the direction of taking away people's freedoms, not only their bodily freedoms, as we've seen recently in the last couple of days, but your freedom of thought and expression. And, you know, I just don't see anything good coming out of society when you start having that tendency. And when you have, you know, a president, as we did in Trump, who gets up there and declares that he's the only real source of truth and that you shouldn't believe anything that you read or hear or the evidence of your own eyes and ears, but just he'll tell you what is true. I mean, as I talk about in my Close to Zero book, he actually said that. And there's a couple of chapters in there that are really more about propaganda than they are about the pandemic itself, because I think those two things just went hand in hand, particularly in 2020, you know, when Trump was still in office. Just the propaganda surrounding the pandemic and what he was trying to achieve with this pandemic by which I don't think he started, but I definitely believe that he perpetuated on purpose. The propaganda surrounding it was just as important as anything else. And it's just, you know, when you become a 24-hour propaganda society, that's not good. It's stifling.
Yeah. No, I absolutely agree with you. I mean, it's intriguing, and it's interesting that, you know, it almost does feel, it makes me wonder about, I suppose, the origin of some of these conspiracy theories and the way they're formed versus now. For instance, we talk about the shootings. The agenda is always, it's almost like, okay, we're gonna give our agenda and then fill everything around this. And no matter what people say, we're just gonna say, yeah, that's because they're trying to take away our rights, versus the way conspiracies used to be formed, which is this piecing together of different things and building up. I mean, I guess I wonder, I don't know if you were privy to anybody that was on the ground floor of building an argument for the Illuminati or something like that, but what comes first, the end point or the various different facts that you gather together to make a case in conspiracy?
Well, I think that's changed too over time, and you know, you need to make a distinction that it wasn't all, you know, not every conspiracy theory back pre, you know, 90, pre whatever 2012 or something was somehow some scientific enterprise. I mean, it
Oh, it
definitely
definitely
was
wasn't.
not. And you know, you go back as far, you can go back as far as you want, and you get groups like the Know Nothings and you know, going even into Europe, there was all these conspiracy theories about the Illuminati. You know, which the Illuminati was this real group, this sort of quasi-Masonic group that existed in the 18th century in Europe. And you know, that's the subject of a lot of, was even then the subject of conspiracy theories. And you know, this has been around for a while. But I will say this: the difference that I have found over time is, you know, a lot of it has to do with the internet, I think, because that has just speeded things up to such an extent that it's possible now to spread a so-called conspiracy theory or conspiracy belief instantaneously around the world. Whereas it wasn't that way before. I mean, if you look at, you go back to say the JFK assassination, you know, I mean, people were always kind of suspicious of what may have happened. But it really took about 2 years, I think it was, before the first real publication of a what you would call a conspiracy theory, or at least questioning the official story. You know, this book, Rush to Judgment, by Mark Lane, a lawyer who was really the first one to come out publicly and write a book questioning the conclusions of the Warren Commission, and that there was just a lone assassin and the evidence didn't add up, and so on and so forth. It took a couple of years. Well, you know, back in, was it, hang on one sec, now your phone's just fell out. Hello, I'm back.
No worries.
So, yeah, you can edit that. So, it was back in, I think, was it 97, I guess. The thing that really, for me and for John Whalen, who I've worked on all those greatest conspiracies books with, was the watershed event for us, I think, was really the death of Princess Diana. Because what happened there was, you know, we used to run this website called conspire.com. It was sort of a supplement to our book, but we had a lot of fun with it. We put a lot of new material on there, and you know, we just had a great time with it, and it helped sell the books. And back in those days, you know, websites were different than they are now. I mean, I think when we started in the mid-90s, you know, there was probably fewer than a million websites online, and ours was one of them. So, you know, you could actually get people on your website and acting on, you know, buying your book. That's changed. But anyway, we would get emails, you know, through the website and messages. And I mean, I was literally within, according to the timestamps, within a couple of minutes after the initial reports of her, you know, death in this auto accident were broadcast on CNN, that we started getting emails about, you know, this obviously was MI5 or MI6 or the royal family or whoever. You know, these conspiracy emails were coming in and instantly. But that's just, you know, it's just not possible. if you're really trying to research a theory, if you really have, if you really want to get to the truth of the matter, you can't do it in a minute and a half. It takes a while. So, you know, and this isn't to comment one way or the other on whatever happened to Princess Diana. I've not really, you know, I've not really researched that deeply. I don't know. But I do know that you can't get to the truth in 2 minutes.
Right.
So, and that's just happened a lot. And we, you know, we did an article for Salon about that. Then we later did a piece about the downing of the TWA 800 flight. At some point, when did we do that? It might have even been before the Diana thing. About how fast that conspiracy theory traveled around the internet. We traced it. We traced the origins of it. That was published in the New York Times Magazine. Actually, if you go to my website, which is just jonathanvankin.net, I think you can see those articles still linked, or at least one of them. You can read them. But, you know, that was at the time we tried to trace that. And again, showed that, like, these so-called conspiracy theories weren't really the product of any sort of research or intellectual process. They were just coming off the cuff, you know, because they sounded cool. And I think in some cases, at least back in those days, people would post them because they did think they were cool. And it was almost like a competition, like who could come up with the craziest theory the quickest, that sort of thing. And some of it was just regurgitating kind of prefabricated ideas, which you'll hear now, you know, whenever there's one of these awful shootings, you hear that it was a quote unquote false flag operation. It just becomes sort of a, like a Mad Libs almost, you know, you just fill in the blanks. And you, there you go. There's your theory.
And, totally. You know,
it's very disappointing, but it's not surprising, I suppose. But I do think that the internet has played a big role in that. You know, when I say the internet, what I really mean is people who use the internet. You know, the technology just is what it is. But the technology exists now that you can spread an idea, no matter what it is, real fast. And if there's an audience for it, they'll spread it even further. And that's what's happening, and it's been happening now really since the late 90s, I think. And now it's, you know, more than ever. And obviously that's how QAnon got going. You just have some person or persons planting these phony messages on the internet, and people just pick up on them, and it spreads like crazy.
Yeah. Were you more optimistic? As I'm getting, I feel the pessimism, or at least I feel the sort of, there does seem a little bit of hopelessness about the state of our nation, Jonathan, from what I'm reading between the lines of what you're saying, but also, or actually just reading the lines, but there's also, you know, I wonder, that's not just you. I mean, I think all of us are just amazed at how this country has changed. But I am curious, do you think you were more optimistic when you wrote those initial conspiracy books in the early 90s?
You know, I don't know. You know, I mean, I think it might be the moment that we're in right now that is making me take that tone. I mean, I am a little pessimistic, but ultimately, you know, I do always have hope, and I did back then. And I do, you know, I've always believed. I mean, this is what, you know, I'm a writer, and that's really what I do for a living, and it's just what I do. And the reason I do it, other than that it's one of the few things I can do, but the reason I do it is that the hope that people read this stuff, and that somehow over time you can start to change people's minds and their points of view. And I think that's really the only way to bring about real substantive change. You know, I mean, and people don't like to hear that because a lot of people, I think, are conditioned, especially in the society today, to want change instantaneously. And, you know, why don't we have all the good things that we should have right away? And I wish we could, but it just doesn't really work that way. And you just have to change. You have to change people's minds from within. And that means putting these ideas out there, writing books, writing articles, writing stories, hopefully doing shows like this podcast or others like it, and just sort of getting these ideas out there. You know, I mean, the word viral you hear a lot now, but I remember when that was first coined, you know, it really made sense. Like, you can plant a virus, a media virus, and spread your idea in the best possible way, you know, and that's what I still hope for. And I think even before the internet, that was really the plan, was like, hey, if I can just get this out there, just get my thoughts out there, somebody is going to hear this. Somebody's going to listen, and they're going to tell somebody, and they're going to tell, and maybe somewhere down the road, you'll get, you know, there'll be like-minded people who write similar things, and somewhere down the road, you'll get a change. And I think if you look at history, that's how it happens. That's how intellectual history, I guess you'd say, the intellectual history of a culture changes, because people's ideas change and people become more open to different thoughts and points of view and information that they hadn't heard before. And it's just what you need to do. So I'm always hopeful that that can be accomplished. You know, short term, things don't look very hopeful, unfortunately, you know, and you just hope that some of the recent things that have happened in the last week, not to mention several years, can be reversed, you know, soon. But it's just, you know, that's hard to do. It's really, really, really hard to do.
Yeah, no, it definitely is. And I mean, I'll admit it. I've gone down different rabbit holes online for sure. I've looked into things that were radically against my belief system, just because I'm going, okay, how deep does this go, this conspiracy? Because I also don't necessarily trust just a simple, oh, this is bunk, dismissal of things. To me, I'm going, okay, well, tell me if you agree with this opinion. Do you think some of these things, I mean, it seems that a lot of these conspiracies today, you don't even think are necessarily even worth exploring. But for instance, this Pizzagate thing, why wouldn't it necessarily be a good use of time to at least really look into the claims and dispel them, just so people will shut up about it?
I mean, I think that's been done, hasn't it? I mean, if that was sort of the forerunner to QAnon, was the Pizzagate thing. I think it's been done sort of ad nauseum, that like it, just explaining why this whole idea was nonsense and ridiculous and dangerous. I mean, it led to someone actually going there and trying to shoot up this place that was, you know, the place where supposedly all these terrible things were happening in the basement that didn't even exist. You know, there was no basement in this place. So, you know, it was just that type of thing.
So do you think that the media does, is it, I mean, I don't know that if it has been done, and I think it, yeah, I mean, look, I've seen enough things that make me go, well, this just seems weird. But I do wonder if there is something that can be done to kind of like popularize the, as opposed to just saying this is bunk and dismissing people's viewpoints. I mean, that just, I think, makes the other side rise up and say, oh, go do your research, go look into it. I mean, how do we get people to accept the critical examination of ludicrous beliefs?
Well, I don't think you can for some people. You know, I think there's definitely a part of the population that's just lost and is never coming back. And I think that's pretty clear. You know, when you see interviews with some of these people and some of the things that have happened, it's like, I think there's just a segment, you know, and there kind of always has been in this country, even before Trump, and there's always been a core of 25 to 30% of people who just have extreme far out beliefs and just aren't ever going to change them. But it, you know, it becomes like a religion. It's a surrogate religion for a lot of people in this position. So, you know, and it's like arguing with someone about their religion. It's like you can make these detailed arguments that God exists or God doesn't exist. You're not going to change anybody's mind, you know, if they have a real profound religious belief one way or the other. It just is what it is. So I think you kind of have to accept that, and you just have to try to reach people who can be reached. And I think there's probably enough of them out there. You know, another problem apparently, I think, in this country is just apathy, you know, apathy and ignorance of people who don't think any of this stuff affects them, you know, until they have to go fill up their gas tank and it's $6 and suddenly they're outraged, but they have no idea why.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, that's a real problem. That's a real problem. And that I think you can change. And I'm not, and again, but it's going to be a long, slow process of changing and educating people about things like that. And you know, it just it's a way, it just has to permeate through society, starting in the home with people's parents and the schools and popular culture and the, and every aspect from top to bottom.
Right.
How is that going to happen? I have no idea. I mean, I think it happens a little bit now when we do see, you know, people say a lot of bad things about the internet, but it also has democratized information, as you know, the existence of a podcast like yours is evidence. You know, you people, there's so many of these things now, so many, it's so relatively easy to start one, not to degrade what you do. I'm sure you put a lot of work into it, as most podcasters do, but the fact is, it's different than, you know, you didn't have to go to a radio station and apply for a job. And when you have to do that, and I found this personally in my own life, it's like when you try to participate in the quote unquote mainstream media, you better be a mainstream person or you're just not gonna get in. And your point of views are not gonna be well expressed by those outlets. So, you know, there's systemic problems there, obviously. But again, I think, you know, this democratization that has happened and is happening is good, you know, even though it's often used to promulgate bad ideas, it can also be used to promulgate good ideas and just, you know, a range of opinions and debate. And I think that's very important.
Yeah. You know, we're going to get to your book, but I have a couple more things about just the field of conspiracy in general. And one of them is, I'm curious your thoughts on people that use well-known historical events, specifically, I'm thinking of Watergate in this case, but, you know, times the U.S. government has historically admitted eventually, yeah, we lied to you. And then conspiracy theorists go, if they did this once, think about how many things we don't know. Now, I realize that it is quite a jump to go from, you know, political intel about something that wasn't relayed to the people to, you know, reptilians fighting under the earth for the sake against Nazis for the sake of saving humanity. But a lot of people make the jump. They say if they lie about this, who says they wouldn't lie about the time travel technology they have, the UFOs, why we're not going to Antarctica? I mean, What is your take on that?
I think it just goes back to the point I made earlier about, you know, this quote unquote transparency or lack thereof. There's that old saying, what is it? Is it information abhors a vacuum? I mean, it's like if you create a vacuum of information and are not honestly telling people facts about things that concern them, people will jump in to fill the void. And sometimes the ideas that they come up with are just completely crazy and insane. And, you know, that's going to happen. So really, again, it's just about more information honestly conveyed, you know, and hopefully getting into people's heads. But, you know, when you withhold too much information, that's going to breed skepticism, and it always will. I don't think that's ever changed, and that much never will change. It's just human nature that when you feel you're being lied to, and oftentimes when you are actually being lied to, it's really hard. And I think, you know, I think in a way that cynicism has also been used as a tool of power and authorities. You know, I think this idea that you hear a lot that, you know, oh, both parties are the same and the whole government is corrupt and all these politicians are on the take and it's all about them. It's like, now I'm saying there's not some truth to that. Of course there is. But I think that prevailing cynicism that we see is very useful to the people who are in power. They don't, it really helps them to have you and I and everybody else just feel like we can't do a damn thing. It's just, they're just so corrupt and awful. We just, you know, what can you do? Don't even bother voting. It's just a waste of time. You know what I mean? It's like that type of thing is exactly what they want. They being, you know, the authority figures in this country, whether they're political or corporate or the media, major corporate media. I mean, it's in their interest for you to have this cynicism and this belief that like everybody is the same, everybody's corrupt, no one does anything. It's just, you know, when you go down that rabbit hole, which a lot of the country has, and in a way, understandably so, it's not like I don't understand why people think that, but at the same time, that cynicism really needs to be combated and fought within ourselves. You know, I think that's an internal battle that people have to have to try to flush that out of their system and realize that is something that is counter to your interests as a human being that has to live in a society with millions of other human beings.
Wow, that is such a good point. Such a good point. I mean, I was just doing, I had an interview recently with someone that, you know, it's kind of like everything in, I see the analogy for the way people conduct their lives there, you know, believing that, well, anything I put my mind to, it's going to be too hard anyways. And then they sit there for years and actually achieve nothing versus taking the action. I mean, if all the people out there that thought their vote didn't matter actually voted, I'm curious how different the outcomes in some of these elections would actually be.
Well, I think they'd be quite different. They'd be quite different. Because I think one thing that we see in this particular society that we live in, the United States of America, is that the people who are the most motivated to vote tend to be the people who are, not entirely, but tend to be the people who are the furthest to the right. And that's why we get this kind of minority rule, where you have, you know, it's a structural problem as well, of course, but I think part of it is just the voting motivation that Republicans, if for lack of a better word these days, the Republicans just will always get out and vote. And they were always, and they're all, and their particular leaders are always ginning them up about one thing or another. You know, I mean, you look at like someone like Ron DeSantis, you know, this governor of Florida, who's supposedly, other than Trump, the front runner for the nomination, for the Republican nomination in 2024. This guy is out there every day, and he's almost every day, and spouting his nonsense and his bigotry and his just terrible ideas and these idiotic laws that he's passing. You know, it's garbage, but he's out there doing it. And it just seems like the lesson that his side understands, that maybe, you know, progressives, liberals, whatever you want to call them, doesn't understand, is that if you want to be in the news and reach people's minds and their hearts, you've got to make news. You know, you can't just sit back and wait. You can't just sit back and think, oh, people will understand that we passed this great bill 8 months ago and it's really helping their lives. It's like, no, you got to go out there every day and tell them and show them, more than telling them, show them what is happening and what will happen if they don't vote the right way or vote at all. And you know, just have to convince them of that. Hopefully not with pure propaganda, but with rational and convincing arguments, but repeated arguments, you know? Things have to be repeated over and over again before people start to believe them.
Well, then let's move into this. I am curious. This book, Close to Zero, How Donald Trump Fulfilled His Apocalyptic Vision and Paid His Debt to Putin with a Devastating Biological Warfare Attack on America. Now, look, this is interesting because it was fun to see that there's a book out there that is a quote-unquote COVID conspiracy book, but it is kind of on the side of... It's on a different side, in a way.
On a different side, but at the same time, yeah, I mean, and it has been accused of being that. But if you actually read the book, you'll see that, I think one of my fortes, if I can pat myself on the back as a writer and a journalist, is doing my research and documenting it. And it's all there. I mean, there's 1,000 footnotes or close to 1,000 footnotes in this book. So any statement of fact that I make in this book, you can check it.
Yeah,
and the URLs are right there. If you're checking, if you're reading it on your iPad or something, you can just click on them and go right there. So it's like everything here is documented. And this was one of the points that I was very very diligent about in creating this book and writing this book was that I wanted to make sure that everything in this book has already been on the public record. So there's nothing in there. There's nothing in there where I'm saying, aha, I know something you don't. I have some secret knowledge. Like, everything in here is something that has already been reported. What I'm trying to do is put it together in a way that gives perspective that I think is correct. But that at the, certainly at the time I was reading it, writing it rather, not many people were really thinking, because I think it's just a really hard thing for people to accept that you have someone who the president deliberately allowing this disease to spread and letting people die on purpose. And believe me, I got a lot of pushback at the very beginning, you know, of like, oh, this is a conspiracy theory and it's just terrible and this is as bad as anything. It's like, no, it's not. And if you go through that book page by page, you'll see that basically everything I say, and I don't say this to brag or boast, it's just a fact that everything I say not only was documented, but has since been confirmed repeatedly. So confirmed in other ways too. I mean, you know, we're seeing all these hearings, these January 6th commission hearings that are telling this very interesting and clear story of how, you know, this coup was planned, carefully planned and carefully carried out. And it didn't work, obviously, at least not to the extent that they wanted it to, but it was all planned and Trump knew about it and took part in it. Well, that's what happened with COVID. Yeah. Not to say that the disease itself was planned, and I think I'm very clear about that in the book, because I do think it's a disease that just happened. But these diseases happen, you know, they're gonna happen. And
right.
And it's the way that you respond to them. And again, a simple fact that I state in the book is that prior to this happening, the United States was rated in terms of preparedness, I think it was like probably the best in the world, or certainly among the top three or four best in the world in terms of preparedness for a global pandemic. But in a very short period of time, we were ranking well down on the list, because our infrastructure for, you know, stopping these things, even before this pandemic hit, had been dismantled by the Trump administration. Why? That's the question that I'm trying to ask in this book. Why? What was going on?
Yeah.
So, you know, I wish I had a magic answer. I don't exactly, but I have some theories that are expressed in the book. And, you know, I think people need to think about them. But again, I think it's very hard to accept that, you know, I think people, it's just hard for people to relate to the type of person that he is and the people who surrounded him and still do are.
You know, yeah.
People who just don't care about anybody else.
Very interesting. I mean, I feel that there are natural distortions of this idea that came out, on the number one being the vaccine as a means of killing off our population, which is just still the logistics to make that happen are just so crazy. But you know, a lot of people.
Well, it also literally makes no sense, because that's just not what happened. I mean, the vaccinations, there was just a study that was published 2 days ago in, I think it was Lancet or one of these big journals, that showed that the COVID vaccines taken in total probably saved about 20 million lives worldwide. Saved 20 million lives. People who would have died had we never developed this vaccine, at least in 2021. So, you know, where people are getting this idea, again, it's the same type of thing. It's like, this was sort of baked in.
Yeah.
That you know, that we were just, from the very beginning, when this Trump started spreading this idea that somehow this whole thing was just a big fake and a hoax, you know, and if it wasn't a hoax, it really wasn't that bad. And if you remember, like, we were all going to be in churches by Easter and there was going to be packed churches, you know, just a month or two after this thing started. I mean, that's what he was trying to, you know, that's the idea he was trying to spread, that this wasn't real. Like everything else that he doesn't like, it was fake, it was a hoax, it was fake news, et cetera, et cetera. Well, that had to catch on. So if it's fake, then this vaccine has to be fake. And that's a logical conclusion. It has to be something else. It has to be some other agenda behind it. But, you know, it's all nonsense and it's all coming from the same font of propaganda.
Jonathan, did you see this from the beginning, the thesis of this book?
Well, yeah, because I started writing it very early on in the whole thing. I think I probably started writing it in March of 2020. So
Wow.
yeah, very early on, I just because and it didn't, it's not like I felt like I had some genius insight. It just to me was obvious that here you had this emergency, this health emergency, and you had these so-called president of the United States. I don't even like to call him that, but that's what he was, the president of the United States, not just doing nothing, but taking steps to actively make it worse. Doing things like encouraging people to do behavior, to take behaviors that would spread the disease. This, I remember, if you remember this whole thing with the meat plants, the meat packing plants, this was also very early on in the whole thing, that these, that meat packing facilities, which are of course staffed by people who are mostly very, low income, minimum wage or less, immigrants for the most
Yeah.
part, were just these petri dishes for this virus, and people were getting very sick and dying. And he, before, before he ever invoked this Defense Production Act to manufacture ventilators and other necessary equipment, he used it to force people to go back to work in these meat packing facilities, literally sending them to potential deaths and certainly making the spread of this virus worse. On purpose, he did that. Why? It's like, but, and that was part of a pattern. And that's what I document in the book. It's like, this was the pattern. Like, why did he not just take no action and not just mishandle or bungle it, but actively made it worse? And that's why I just started asking that question. Like, what the hell is going on here? And that was the genesis of the book, So yeah, it was very, very early on.
Yeah. Well, the thing I was going to say that also is where people stop, is this, yeah, he wanted to win again. He's selfish. So he wanted to do, he's just the type of person that does the opposite of what he says, and he wanted to downplay it, right? We even heard that. He said, "Well, I don't want to bum people out. I don't want to make them upset." What are some of the things that were in plain sight that you go into this book about that show you that no, it's not just incompetency. This is part of his plan.
Well, I certainly think, looking at it in retrospect, one of the last things I wrote in the book was this afterword that I called the pandemic push, where I, push meaning coup, where I wrote about what happened. Right, very shortly after it happened, so I didn't have all the information we have now. But what I did explain was how that could not have happened without the pandemic. And the pandemic, whether by design or not, and I'm not saying like he planned all this in advance, because I don't think he's that smart, but he understood it. And the people around him understood that this could be used to create a voting pattern that at least he thought would be favorable to him if he did certain things. And one of those things would be to discredit the use of mail-in ballots, which of course would be, which traditionally favor Republicans, but in this case would have favored Democrats because the Democrats were the ones who were tended to be much more cautious about not getting the disease. So tended to vote by mail rather than in person. And Trump's whole thing was to encourage people to vote in person on the day of the election, and then get the voting to stop and discredit the mail ballots as all fraudulent and whatever. He's still doing it.
Yeah.
That's still what he's saying when he goes out on these stump speeches today. But that was, I think, clearly part of what he was trying to accomplish. And he realized that early on and made a number of public statements, some of which I cite in the book, about this, like in the early summer of 2020. So the idea that somehow he just wasn't even thinking about it is contradicted by his own statements. Was right away talking about how, we want to make sure these mail-in ballots aren't counted and they're all fraudulent and, et cetera, et cetera. And, all these statements that we know and we've heard a million times. But at the same time, it's like this, I think, was a big motivation for what he did. But I also want to know, and I don't have an answer to this, and I wish I did, but I talk about in the book that there's something going, there's, you know, look, throughout his whole adult life, he's had this strange relationship with Russia. And even before Putin came along, with the Soviet Union, and then when Putin came along, he's just has some sort of connection to this guy. And I'm not sure exactly what it is, but it goes back a long time. And, you know, in 2007, he's writing these fan letters to Putin, and it just goes on and on and on. But then what I wanted to know is why during, I think it's the first 4 months of the pandemic, there was 8 phone calls between Trump and Putin, including one that happened on December 29, 2019, just 2 days before the Chinese government announced to the World Health Organization that they had found this novel coronavirus, and that this was the cause of what was then an outbreak in China, in the Wuhan province, of this strange respiratory disease. So just 2 days before they made that announcement to the world, Putin calls Trump on his personal cell phone on the golf course. What were they talking about?
Yeah.
I mean, the public readout was that, oh, he was trying to thank Trump for some sort of help in stopping a terrorist operation. You know, maybe. But why do you have to call him on the golf course? You know what I mean? On his personal cell phone. Shouldn't that be a more formal call? I mean, that's the way world leaders usually communicate. It's these very, you know, well-planned out, scheduled calls that are listened to by a number of other people. And then they just kept talking and talking. And I think there was one like 3 or 4 week span where they talked like 3 or 4 times. And that, for two world leaders to talk to each other, I don't care if it's Trump and Putin or any two world leaders, or if it was, you know, Biden and Trudeau, they just don't talk that often. It's just not how it worked. So why were these two people talking to each other on the phone so often in the middle of this incredibly grave crisis? I'd like an answer to that. And I don't necessarily have one, but I think, you know, what I try to do in the book is raise the question, and maybe somebody with greater resources than I can really investigate this and figure out what was going on there.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. I mean, what do you think then of what Robert Mueller came up with in terms of this? I mean, that's very specifically, I suppose, about collusion. But right. There were a lot of efforts to, from the Democrats especially, to try to connect Trump to Russia. Where did they fall short, in your opinion, if they did?
I mean, I don't think they did fall that short. I don't think the full story has really been told or exposed, the full story. And that's what I was just saying. It's like there's still a lot of weird stuff there that we don't totally know what was going on. Of course, there's the famous incident in Helsinki where Trump sent, you know, tore up the translator's notes and wouldn't allow anyone into this conference he had with Putin. It's like, what were they talking about? We still don't know to this very day. We have no idea what that was all about. But, you know, and then he comes out and gives this joint press conference with Putin where he seems very subservient to him.
Yes.
And says this thing about, well, you know, he says he didn't interfere and that's good enough for me. It's like, what was going on? We just don't know. I mean, I don't even really have a theory other than things that people would probably already guessed. In terms of Mueller and the Mueller report, I think, you know, to me, what the most interesting thing about the Mueller report was that no matter what you think of it or what it established, Mueller did very clearly identify 10 charges of obstruction of justice against Trump and said in his congressional testimony that Trump could be prosecuted on these charges as soon as he was no longer president. Well, he's been no longer president for 17 months, 18 months now. What's going on? Like, why is he still out there golfing and making these idiotic speeches? It just, I really would like to know what is going on there. I don't know if it's anything nefarious. It could be just timidity and like just a reluctance to do it. And oh, we're going to get political backlash, just cowardice, really. I mean, that's probably my best theory. But whatever it is, it's wrong. And, you know, people who commit these crimes need to pay for them, just like everyone else.
Yeah. Have you looked into the work of Seth Abramson and all?
Oh, yeah. 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 I've read a lot. I haven't read his books, but I certainly followed his Twitter feed quite a bit. And I thought he did a lot of good stuff. And I thought he tended to be kind of, I mean, I don't really consider him a conspiracy theorist per se, but he had some of those tendencies, which is define two facts and kind of jump to a conclusion that isn't always right. supported by the facts that he has. But, you know, there was a guy who, again, kind of like May Brussel, who I mentioned earlier, was doing that very similar kind of research where he's going through the public media and finding just so much stuff that has been reported, but at the same time is not necessarily widely known, and piecing it all together in a way that, you know, may be true in some cases, may not be in some cases. But I thought it was very valuable. And I thought, like, you know, without endorsing all of his points of view, which I don't, I did think he did a lot of valuable stuff.
Yeah. Fascinating stuff. And I also wonder about this apocalyptic vision that you're pointing to here. I mean, what do you think this means?
I have a whole chapter. The chapter two is all about that in the book, because I think it's very important. And I think it sort of goes back to what I was saying earlier about how I think people don't necessarily understand. It's very hard for people who aren't this way to grasp how somebody can be, you know, a psychopath, basically, and have no real conscience. And in fact, not only that, but actually wish harm on other human beings actively for no good reason. And Trump has a very long history of making public statements, not of committing violence himself, because he probably is too cowardly to do that. And that's probably good. I'm glad that he doesn't do that, or hasn't, that we really know of. But he's made a number of public statements that show this kind of lust for destruction and lust for chaos. And it goes back long before he was president, when he would often offer himself as an expert on things like nuclear policy and many other things that he was not an expert on.
Yeah.
There was one quote, it wasn't that long before he ran for president, it might have been just a year or so before, where he was talking about Pakistan. I can't, there's a few. It's all in chapter two, which I haven't, you know, I wrote but have not memorized everything I wrote. I haven't read it back in a little while, but basically, you know, he'd make these quotes that, well, when everything goes to hell and we have riots in the streets, that's when America is going to be great again. You know, and he would literally say things like that and on repeated occasions. And then, of course, even like during his presidency, like look, during the whole George Floyd summer, you know, he just took this glee publicly, just in speaking in public. This glee in the idea of like just beating these protesters and having the cops tear gas them. You know, there was this guy who, I forget his name, but who was accused of shooting and killing a pro-Trump person during one of these protests. Now, I don't even know whether this guy actually did it or not. He was accused of it, but he was never arrested or tried or brought to trial. He was essentially summarily executed by U.S. Marshals, who caught up to him outside his apartment and just shot him dead. And that's not how our system is supposed to work, obviously. You know, if this guy committed this crime, he should have been arrested and tried for it and hopefully convicted. But we'll never really know, because he was just shot down in the street by the police. But Trump was celebrating this. He would give speeches about what a great thing it was that this guy was, you know, they just took him out, they handled it. It's like, he just loves this stuff. He's a person who loves the idea of violence and death and mass destruction. And I document that in the book, and particularly in that chapter, which is the second chapter of the book. So if anyone wants to pick it up and read it, that's what you're gonna get. And that's what I call the apocalyptic vision. And it also ties into his background, whereas even as a kid, he was raised in kind of in a cult. You know, I mean, of course, his father was this big real estate developer, but they belonged to this church in New York that was essentially a cult. And if you look at how Trump operates and the way fascism operates, it's very similar to how cults operate. And conspiracy theories, as we were talking about earlier, become tools of the leaders of cults to gain control over their followers. You know, they have to inculcate them with this idea that somehow the world is out to get them, the world is out to get their leader, that he or she is in possession of some truth or facts that they, quote unquote, don't want you to know. And they, quote unquote, are trying to kill this leader all the time. I mean, all these things, these conspiracy theories are then used to bring people into line and brainwash them, essentially. And that's what Trump did. and tries to continue to do, even though he's not in quite the same position.
This is very interesting in the sense of, to me, sometimes when I think on Trump's trajectory in the public sphere, I'm going, you know, he could have just kept doing more. I mean, people had the theory. I remember hearing that he ran for president to boost ratings for The Apprentice, and that he wasn't really gonna do it, and it was just a publicity stunt. But I do wonder, I'm curious, I mean, I know this isn't really the topic of the book, but do you believe that having this kind of power was something he always wanted and was inevitable?
Well, I think definitely, and I think the evidence for that is the fact that this was not the first time he ran for president. He ran for president in 2000, he didn't last very long, but he did run for president. He ran on the Reform Party ticket, which, if you remember, that was the party that was started by Ross Perot.
Yes.
I don't know if you're old enough to remember that guy, but he was around in the early 90s. I think he ran in 92 and 96.
Oh,
and
yeah.
And got a fairly significant number of votes. And, you look at those elections and you look at Bill Clinton, obviously won them both, but usually with less than 50% of the popular vote, because there were three candidates who were getting significant numbers of votes. Obviously Perot was way behind, but you know, he didn't get like 1 or 2 or 3%. He got like, I don't remember the exact percentages, but it was double digits. So he started this party, and in the year 2000, he was not going to run. So Trump decided to run as a Reform Party candidate. And as I say, eventually withdrew, but his ambitions to be president go back a long way. So the idea that somehow he was just doing this on a lark or a whim, I don't think really holds up if you look at his history.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. That makes sense. This whole... I mean, this guy killing the people deliberately. I mean, was this just... was this just happenstance that the virus came in? I mean, people talk about the lab thing. People talk about where this could, you know, I forget what you say. Like, was he just capitalizing on something that happened?
Well, I think so. I think it's opportunistic. And if you look at it, that's also how Putin operates. I mean, Putin has always been very opportunistic. Like, people think of him as this sort of criminal evil mastermind, which he kind of is in a way, but most of what he's done over his career has been responding to opportunities that arise, that he considers to be opportunities. And that's really what Trump did too. And I think this was an opportunity that arose for him. And, you know, I just wonder, and I argue this in the book, and I just wonder if those phone calls with Putin didn't have at least something to do with Putin counseling him on what to do. And that he may have been taking instructions from Putin on how to handle this, or at least taking advice, let's say. And I talk in the book about at least one other instance where I think you can kind of prove that that happened, an unrelated instance. I don't need to go into all the details, but it had to do with the Trump Tower meeting and their public response to that. The Putin essentially dictated a statement to Trump, which Trump then had his son, who of course was the person who was in that meeting, issue. So I think that's pretty clear that happened. So if that happened once, I don't think it's implausible that could happen again. And why is he talking to Putin so often anyway? What are they talking about? I mean, I just think probably he was taking some sort of advice or counsel, or they were kicking around ideas or something. And I think probably a lot of what he did during the pandemic was stuff that he, if he didn't get the ideas from Putin, his ideas were certainly reinforced and encouraged in those phone calls. That's my guess. I don't have evidence for that, but I would really like to know.
Yeah. Does where the virus comes from matter to you at all?
I don't think it really matters that much, to tell you the truth. I really don't.
A lot of people think it does.
But it just doesn't. Yeah. It's just, to me, it's like, what are we really talking about? It's like these coronaviruses have been around for a long time. So the idea that this was somehow a deliberately created one, well, why would this one be deliberately created and the other ones weren't? It's like, it all to me just seems like a knee-jerk reaction without any type of real backing to it.
Right.
That's how I see it. It's like, it's just, you know, show me something. and show me why I should, why it means something. Why would Trump's behavior have been appreciably different either way? I don't think so.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the thing you hear is, that, I mean, there's just so many things, you know, that what's his face, Fauci's connected to the Wuhan lab, Bill Gates guy, his that friend from Harvard bringing the vials from, I mean, it does seem, they make it seem like there's all this shady stuff going on, but at the same time, it's,
well, that's the nature of the game these days, right? That's the nature of the beast. It's like to get you to act against your own interests.
Yeah,
very, very simple in this case, which is just, you know, try to protect yourself and others. That's really what this whole thing was about. Just try to protect yourself and other people. That's all we ask. But this, and then that's, I think, a basic human instinct. You know, most people want to live and they probably want other people around them to live and be healthy. So you had to be convinced not to do that. And that's what all this stuff is really about, in my view.
Fascinating stuff. Everybody needs to check out this book, Close to Zero, How Donald Trump Fulfilled His Apocalyptic Vision and Paid His Debt to Putin with a Devastating Biological Warfare Attack on America. Jonathan, let me ask you this. Of all the Roswell people you spoke with over the years, the UFO thing, I mean, we get a lot in the media right now about this.
Yes.
What do you make of the alien problem that's going on?
I mean, you know, I don't make that much of it. I think it's really interesting. I do. You know, I think it's fascinating that there are these files and that the Air Force has been investigating this stuff. You know, I can't say I have any well-formed theory about the truth behind it all, but I think it's great. I think it's super entertaining. I guess that's what I'd say. It's really fun stuff. And
do you believe that Roswell was just a weather balloon?
I don't know what it was. I mean, the weather balloon explanation has always seemed kind of lame to me.
Yeah.
But, you know, chances are in most of these cases, it's probably some sort of military technology that the military doesn't want you to know about. I mean, that's usually my guess, because that seemed like the most likely explanation. And we know those things exist. We know that's what really happens at Area 51, is that they developed things that we haven't heard of yet. You know, that's where they developed the stealth fighter back before anyone had heard what that was. And it goes back a long way. I mean, I think probably the U-2 plane was developed either there or somewhere just like there. Everyone knows what that is now, or if you follow this sort of thing, but back in the early 60s, that was super, super secret. You know, so there's always these super secret military aviation technologies and other technologies. And I think that probably has a lot to do with what is going on. Maybe not everything. I think there's definitely some weird stuff out there. Again, yeah. I don't really have any specific theories that I'm wedded to or feel strongly about. It's just that it's all interesting. And I think the stuff, you know, it's really worth looking into because something is happening.
So would you say that you are, and I've always said this on my show, Robert McGuffey said it too, and Robert Anton Wilson really played in that agnostic space. Is that where you are with matters of the spiritual and the paranormal and ultimately even some conspiratorial things?
Yeah, I would say so. I would say that's a pretty good characterization. It's like, I don't want, you know, it's like, I think knowledge is, I think we know very little. Even though our knowledge of the universe and how it works has expanded tremendously, I think there's still a long way to go. So who am I to say that I had know anything, really? You know? So yeah, I'd say probably that's a good description. The agnostic space. Yeah, I mean, I think with Robert Anton Wilson, you know, he was brilliant, and I really liked his point of view about things of this nature, that let's play around with them because we don't really know. Now, the difference is when he was writing, when he was alive, as we've described earlier in this interview, things were a little different and playing around with his ideas wasn't quite as dangerous as it later became when they were sort of seized by, you know, the people in power. But I do think that that sense of just experimenting with thoughts is really valuable.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I suppose as somebody that is doing his journalistic work, i.e. me, talking to different people on the show and entertaining former people involved with the military and others that claim they've been part of secret government space programs and were abducted and all this stuff. I mean, it sometimes becomes there is this I want to believe thing going on inside of me. But there's also the reality that I will never know unless I experience it myself. And even then, how do I trust what's happening in my mind? But I guess I'm curious for you. I don't know, when you were doing that research for 2 years on your first book, or in general throughout your research, have you ever encountered someone that is straight up the wall, defies rationality, that something inside you went, but there might be something truthful here?
Maybe. I mean, sure. It depends who you're talking about. Again, it defies rationality. I don't know. I mean, when I think of people like Mae Brussel, a lot of her stuff was really off the wall, but I do think there was probably a lot of truth in some of her theories, or at least suggestions of truth. And I would definitely suggest that people go back and listen to her old tapes and read about her. You know,
I think
she was
that,
quite a character.
yeah, I want to look into that for sure. I wasn't familiar with her.
Yeah. Oh,
I
yeah.
think
She's one of the greats.
I was going to say mostly, and I think you have a chapter about this. I'm very curious about Al Bielek and Preston Nichols and the Montauk stuff, because I mean, if you watch videotapes of Al Bielek, you're sitting there going, "Why is this guy talking about traveling inside other bodies and just re having an age regression on sight?" I mean, machines that do these wonderful things. You kind of go, okay, if they're not telling the truth, then what is actually happening inside their heads? What is their experience of life?
Yeah, well, I think you could say that about a lot of people who've encountered quote unquote UFOs or been UFO abductees. You know, it's like there's so many, and they describe these similar experiences that it's like, well, are they all lying? It's hard to believe that. Some of them are, but are they all lying? I just don't know. You know, what is going on? What is going on in their minds? What did they experience? I think that's fascinating. Again, I don't know. I can't say, oh yeah, this it was, you know, an alien abduction or whatever. I don't know. I don't know what it was. I kind of doubt that, but it's something. It's something. So I think that's really something that people should look at and not dismiss people out of hand who've had anomalous experiences.
Yeah. Well, that's good. So you've kept an open mind after even after all these years.
Yeah, for sure. For sure.
Yeah. I wonder what would tip you over the edge. Maybe would encountering a UFO? If you saw a UFO, would you all of a sudden, I guess I'm wondering,
Mean, I
yeah.
still want to ask, what is it? What have I just seen? You know, because you look at everything, whether it's that or anything else, you know, facts are theory laden, right? It's like everything that you see, you're seeing through the perceptions of your own prior previously held beliefs about the world. So if you're someone who's inclined to think that if you see a light in the sky, it's a UFO or an alien spacecraft, then that's what you're going to think. If you're not inclined to think that, you're going to think something that is something else. Because and you can say that about almost anything in the world that you see. It's like your perceptions and your belief system determines and influences how you perceive everything. So if I saw something like that, what would I think? Well, I don't know. It would depend what it was. It would depend what it looked like. It would depend how it behaved. It would, you know, and I'd want to know. I'd want to ask questions as to like, well, what was that? What happened? Rather than just make an assumption about it.
Yeah. Wow. Well, look, I appreciate that you're still out there doing this work. I feel that this is a very interesting case that you're making here. I mean, would you I don't know if that's your goal, but Would you want to see this book be used as a resource to get Trump in jail?
Well, I think, you know, he certainly deserves to be in jail, whether it's from what's in my book or something else, I don't know. But I think, like, I definitely would like to see my book more widely distributed, and you know, it did okay, but I think it could have done better. And I think it's a point of view and a set of facts that more people need to deal with and confront. Because I just don't, I don't think that even now it's been fully dealt with, you know, and it's been fully understood what happened and what he did over those 2 years or year and a half or whatever it was that he was handling this situation. And, you know, I mean, there is a committee that's investigating the COVID-19 response right now in Congress, but we need something even bigger. We need something like the January 6th committee that's really going to get up there and systematically tell a story. And that's what I try to do in the book, is systematically tell that story that at the time no one else is really telling. I mean, there's been other books about it, but I just felt that mine was the one that's taking what is known, and it's not trying to like show, oh, well, Dr. Burke said this behind the scenes. It's like, well, great, who cares, really? It's like, I just want to know what happened and why it happened, not the palace gossip, you know. So that's, yeah, I would definitely hope that people would look at my book and use it as a foundation for looking further into this and maybe doing something about it, because I just think it's a terrible, you know, it's a miscarriage of justice that nothing is being done about this. And it never should have happened in the way that it did. Yeah, which is not to say that the pandemic would have been prevented or stopped by someone who dealt with it more responsibly, but I don't think it would have been as bad. I think there were definitely ways to handle it that could have minimized the impact. And you see that in other countries too, like, you know, South Korea or New Zealand. It's like, yeah, they got hit, but it definitely was better there than here. And that was really all because of the political leadership.
Fascinating stuff. And you have so many, and less people think this is just, you know, someone self-publishing a book, I mean, and no one's heard of it. I mean, you have Adam Gorightly, who's written praise for this book. Ken Thomas, author of Trumpocalypse Now. I mean, some pretty good names who have read this book, who've acknowledged that it makes a compelling case. And I think if you want to see another side of this that is well documented, I mean, it would be a shame to neglect this perspective. So I'm definitely hoping that you coming on the show gets more exposure to it. We will link to that as well.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate that. I hope so too.
Yeah, absolutely. Jonathan Vankin, author of Close to Zero: How Donald Trump Fulfilled His Apocalyptic Vision and Paid His Debt to Putin with a Devastating Biological Warfare Attack on America. I really wanted it to be about the pee tape. I know that's a myth. I was really hoping that Donald Trump was pissed on by a bunch of prostitutes. In your research,
would be fun, wouldn't it? That would be great.
Is there anything with Russian prostitutes and Trump at all, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think probably. I mean, why not? You know? And I think there was some evidence that something like that may have occurred, but, you know, who knows? And would it make any difference? Would anyone even care if such a tape was, you know, surfaced? I kind of don't think it would.
Yeah, I mean, and it's never about, I mean, look, even with the Stormy Daniels stuff, you were kind of hoping that this guy would be, you never see him get humiliated. No. You never see that. And that to me is the most frustrating. It's like when you go to a roast and the guy never doesn't flinch at all at the comics taking him down. I mean, it's this guy does not experience humiliation. And I mean, do you agree with the narcissistic sociopath analysis?
Yeah, well, something. Yeah. I mean, he's clearly, you know, a deranged individual.
Yeah.
I don't think there's any doubt about that. I mean, I'm not a psychologist or psychiatrist, but there's definitely something wrong with this guy. There's no doubt in my mind. Something deeply, deeply, deeply wrong, and someone who had no business being anywhere near any position of power, much less the presidency.
Yeah.
But that's my feeling.
Very cool. Well, Jonathan Vankin, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for your contribution to the countercultural field. Is it possible to have counterculture again, do you think?
Yeah, I think so. Why not? I mean, I think it's, I don't know if you'd even call it counterculture because, again, we live in this sort of distributed culture thanks to the
Yes.
internet and communications technology. But you can have pockets of culture that are outside of the mainstream, and we certainly do. And I guess your podcast is part of it, so I think that's fantastic.
Yes. Well, thank you for being a part of it.
Thanks for having
Yeah,
me.
very much enjoyed this conversation, Jonathan.
All right, me too. Thank you very much.
Thanks. Thank you, Jonathan. Jonathan Vankin, everyone. Is this show passé for liking conspiracies? Nah. Should Donald Trump have taken out as many people as he did? Nah. But do we think the pandemic was good for reducing the number of improv shows that people would have to endure? Absolutely. I want to thank Rodney McGilvray for the theme music, Zero Boy for the pre-theme music, and you. I owe you the world. Talk to you soon.